At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. Today I'm joined by Chloe Grande. Chloe is a Canadian mental health blogger, writer and speaker. Chloe has personal experience of anorexia nervosa and following a relapse decided to start her blog to raise awareness of eating disorders. Chloe also has experience of social anxiety disorder, which is what we're discussing today. Hello, Chloe.
Hello, thank you for having me.
No, it's so lovely to have you. How are you?
I'm doing great. You know, also going through a heat wave here in Canada right now. So there's that. But otherwise, you know, I love summer weather. It makes me so happy.
Yeah, good. Yeah, it's funny because, like, I mean, I record these podcasts in advance, obviously, but when this one comes out, we probably won't be in the heat wave anymore. So just for anybody listening, just remember that time where we were all complaining about the 40 degree heat. And Chloe has it pretty similar, even though she's in Canada. So, yeah, unfortunately, I think the world is just getting warmer, which is not so great. But at least we'll get a nice tan. So I'm really excited to speak to you today. I think what we're talking about, a lot of people will have experience of. And actually, one thing I'm really interested to talk about to you is I've been experiencing not social anxiety disorder, but something a bit similar recently in terms of anxiety. And I'm really interested to get your insight on like how to navigate certain things. But I will come back to that later. So I guess, did you want to start with explaining your experience of having an eating disorder?
For sure. So for me, I would say my eating disorder started when I was a teenager. And just to give some context about what I was like, I was competing in gymnastics at the time. I was a very high-achieving, perfectionistic student. And I also had low self-esteem. So sort of a combination of all of these things made me probably a bit more likely to develop an eating disorder given my personality. And it was actually my gymnastics coach that pulled me aside and asked if anything was going wrong. So that was like a huge turning point because, as you know, with eating disorders, like it's so hard to see anything is wrong with you. So that was the first time that I sort of had a wake-up call, but there was a lot of denial, and my coach was very insistent, so he connected me to a school counselor, and then eventually my parents got involved, and we started doing family-based therapy. But flipping ahead, I guess it's now 10 years in the future, I was doing really well and in recovery, and I think the pandemic just changed everything for me. It was like I instantly reverted back to all these really unhelpful coping mechanisms and behaviors, and essentially felt like I had to start all over, you know, as an adult and learn different strategies. I was no longer a teenager who was relying on my family to make sure that I was eating enough. You know, this was my sole responsibility. And when I went through that second recovery, that's when I started blogging. And it's eventually led me to create actually my own business. Speaking about eating disorder recovery. So it's, yeah, something positive has come out of a really challenging experience.
Well, can I just say that's amazing, the fact that you've, you know, flipped something negative on his head. I think that is, you know, really hats off to you, because that's amazing that you've been able to do that. I just wanted to pick up on something that you said. So before the pandemic, you said that kind of things were going well, and I think you said you were in recovery. So had you reached a point of like eating disorder kind of wasn't part of your life anymore, or was it still there and you were working your way through that?
What I recognize now is I was in partial recovery. So once I relapsed over the pandemic and saw this new therapist, she was like, you know, you still aren't eating enough. You do realize that, right? And it's difficult because like diet culture, fat phobia, like all these things like normalize disordered eating. Mm-hmm. So I think from the outside, no one else would recognize it. But like with my history of an eating disorder, like I knew I had to work basically twice as hard to fight against that voice.
Yeah. I think you're so right in terms of, you know, diet culture and things like that. I think in, you know, recovery, regardless of whatever, is hard. But when everybody else around you is just engaging in these behaviors that you're being told you have to let go of because, you know, that's really affecting your mental health, I think that makes it like excruciatingly more difficult. I think navigating that when everyone around you is doing it.
It really is, can be isolating, I find, at times as well, because you feel you're going against the grain in some ways. And obviously, it's the right thing to do, but it's challenging. Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And I think because of that, like you said, with your sort of feeling like you were partially in recovery, I think it makes it easy to slip into that sort of partial recovery. And I just wanted to ask you, you know, obviously, you realized that from your relapse, but I guess you know, if you could prevent a relapse, it's not great to just have a relapse just so that you realize you're partially in recovery. So would you have any tips to people to sort of recognize if they're not, because I think there's denial in where you are at in recovery as well. So if you had any tips of being able to recognize that for people.
One thing I worked on with my therapist sort of near the end of our sessions at that period was putting together a list of green, yellow, and red flags. So like we, instead of just being like, oh, a red flag is like when I'm in a full relapse, like yellow flags were like, for me personally, major life transitions can be when other eating disorder symptoms start slipping up again. And I think that may be the case for a lot of people, you know, as we transition seasons, the pandemic, obviously, moving, relationships, all those kind of things. So putting together the yellow flags where it's like, I may be a bit more vulnerable at this point. Where am I getting support? What do I have already in place before I get to the red flag and need more help?
And I think being able to recognize what that is for you, like you said, it's almost, you're almost catching it before it's even started, because you've said that could potentially be something that may be tricky. And I guess as well, even if you don't think, okay, that specific situation that is now happening to me, that was a yellow flag, you might not have caught that one specifically, but you would hope that from thinking about the others, you would have things that you could implement to be like, this is how I catch myself before the, before the relapse happens or things like that.
Mm-hmm. I would say it is something that's always on your mind. I know this is like really common in the recovery community. It's a lifelong commitment, or it's something you work hard on every day and it doesn't really go away. Like it is in the back of my mind. I mean, I hope one day I don't have to think as hard about it, but it's a huge, it is a lot of work. So anyone going through recovery, I hope they're able to recognize the important work that they're doing and sort of give themselves a pat on the back, even if others aren't recognizing that work.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, that is something we actually, thank you for bringing it up, because I don't think we talk about that enough on the podcast, on, you know, how difficult recovery is and how hard it is to every day pick yourself up. And you know, it's not just like you start in the morning and you go, it's every meal, every snack, you know, making the right choice, doing the right thing. So it's tiring, but I think, you know, if you can do it, the rewards further down the line, although it may not feel like it when you're in recovery, are so worthwhile for that freedom overall compared to kind of what you're entrenched in right now.
Oh, 100%. That was beautifully said. I was thinking recently too, in some sense, it's kind of boring. Like, recovery is really boring. It's like you're just doing the same thing over and over again. like, it's not super exciting. So anyways, I was thinking about that one day when I was like, oh gosh, snack time again. Here we go.
Yeah. I think that's another really important thing to say, is that it's not the most exciting thing. And it can get really boring, and it can just feel like it's meal after snack after meal. But we almost, I think there is a glorification of recovery, and that it is this exciting, you know, you get to go out for cake and ice cream, and you do all these things. And, you know, obviously there are those moments, and that's brilliant. And they are great moments, and that's really exciting. But like, that's not really the main element of it. And actually, like you say, the sort of repetitive stretch, I think, can feel quite dull. But then with that, I think, comes so much more excitement everywhere else, rather than, like, I was thinking about this the other day, how I used to get so excited, be like, oh, I'm going out for a burger tonight, and I'm so excited, and all my energy was focused on that. And now I'm like, hey, yes, that's cool that I'm going out for dinner, but actually I'm really excited to see my friends rather than the food I'm going to eat. Like, I think your perspective, well, mine personally anyway, shifts onto what's exciting now. Like, I'm not really enthralled by going out for dinner, but seeing my friends is really exciting. And the fact that I can be present in that moment is really exciting.
Yeah, just like the scope of your life opens up so much more, and it's not so narrowly focused on food. That's so true. Even myself, I was out for dinner recently, and it was like, oh my gosh, I didn't research all the restaurants in the area. I didn't look at the menus in advance. Like, so for someone who's not in recovery, that might seem very small and insignificant. But for those of us who, you know, poured hours into doing research and like had meltdowns when they don't have the menu item that we thought we wanted to order, it is such a weight lifted off our shoulders. Like, there's just so much more brain energy focused elsewhere.
Yeah. And I think those reflections, like you said, about going out for dinner the other day, and then like not actively thinking beforehand, I'm not going to check the menu, but actually realizing when you're there, I didn't need to check the menu. I took my partner out on Monday for a 7-course taster meal, and like, it's something that he loves doing. He loves like fine dining and stuff. Not something I enjoy in the slightest. More because I'm more like, I just want to go out for pudding rather than anything else. I just want a big bowl of ice cream.
Oh, that's what
I said to him
is.
At the end. I was like,
pudding is different for us.
Oh, what did you think pudding was?
Like, pudding's, I don't know, it's almost like Jell-O, like mushy old people food. So you're saying ice cream and pudding?
Like
is
a
the
rice
same?
Pudding.
Yes.
So yeah, so pudding, oh wow, this is great. Pudding in the UK is like, it's like a what's the word, synonym for dessert. So it's like the same thing as dessert. So it's just like a broad term for like anything you'd have after your main.
Gotcha. Okay. Just had to clarify there. I'm like, excited for pudding. Like,
no, that's is she actually 25? Because she looks 25, but actually she's 19.
So sorry. Okay, continue.
But yeah, and so that was really good, because now if there's any American, Canadian, or I don't know whether this in America it's pudding as well, but then you'd be like, actually she's talking about what she eats after. But yeah, so we were there, and I was like, you know, it's your birthday, I don't want to like go on about this, and I don't want to dwell, but can we just recognize the fact that today, like, I haven't restricted what I've eaten everything I wanted at this dinner. And I was like, that's actually mad that this is where we're at now. Like, I didn't ever think, you know, the thought of going out for a taster menu before was like way in the distance. Yeah. But I think it does just creep up on you. But I think it's really important to kind of sit back and recognize when those moments happen as well.
Oh, congratulations. That's amazing.
Anyway, now we have spoken about pudding and my win. Actually, when I was talking about going out for dinner, I realised that what we're talking about today is social anxiety disorder. And I was just going to link that in, and then I started talking about this 7-course taster meal. But obviously, as we mentioned in the introduction, you said that you have social anxiety disorder. And I wondered if, for the listeners, you wanted to explain what that means and maybe how that's different to, like, generalized anxiety disorder.
Right. So the best way I can put it, I think there's perhaps a misunderstanding that social anxiety is a fear of people, a fear of being in public. And we picture someone that is very isolated, never leaves their house. But the reality is you can't necessarily tell if someone has social anxiety. And for me, the way it shows up is more fear of judgment. So I am constantly thinking about others' perception in a lot of things that I do, whether it's going for walks, whether it's grocery shopping. It's almost like I feel as though everyone is noticing my flaws and being hypercritical of me, which in reality isn't the case, but it makes it extra challenging to put myself out there. And I feel that the pandemic really, really heightened the social anxiety. You know, before the pandemic, because we weren't so isolated, I think my social anxiety was at bay. Like, I was able to function pretty well. And then once we went into lockdown and when masks came out, a lot of the messaging was avoid other people, stay away from them, you know, cross the street, like other people are dangerous. And that fed into my social anxiety so, so much. And it was really, really difficult to unlearn that mindset because in some ways my social anxiety was keeping me safe. Similar to eating disorder recovery, a lot of the recovery for social anxiety, again, is very boring, and it just is doing those things that we're scared of doing and doing them over and over again until the level of anxiety comes down.
Well, and I can imagine, especially during the pandemic, I guess this was similar with eating disorder recovery as well, is that a lot of the things that you're asked to do, you know, in eating disorder recovery, it might be go to a cafe for breakfast or go out for dinner or whatever. I guess with, you know, social anxiety disorder, if it's like a CBT based thing, it might be, you know, to go outside and to say hello, or, you know, to like try and leave that judgment at home or whatever. We can't do any of that because you're, like you said, you're being told to stay at home. Mm-hmm. And I don't know whether you had this experience, but I definitely felt like during the pandemic, things in terms of my eating disorder did get worse. Not out of me like actively trying to, but just because I wasn't able to practice those skills. The best I could do was to go to a bakery and bring a cake home. But that felt, for me anyway, it felt quite safe compared to going out, eating around other people, kind of, you know, I was still able to sort of be like, oh, I'm not going to finish that or whatever. Did you think, is that something you experienced?
Yeah, for sure. And I think the biggest thing for me was when I relapsed with my eating disorder and started seeing this new therapist, she was the one that pointed out, oh, you know, I think there is some underlying social anxiety. And I didn't realize it. But the more we talked about it, I realized that this was separate from my eating disorder. Like, it wasn't, it existed even when my eating disorder wasn't at its peak. So I think maybe other people also during the pandemic might have this realization that they also were a bit more socially anxious. I did some polls on my Instagram, which are no way, you know, scientific research, but I found that a lot of people were saying, yes, I did feel a lot more anxious, and wearing a mask made me feel safe. And even with my eating disorder too, like, the mask was almost a way to take off that focus on my appearance. So when we had our mask mandates lifted, that was absolutely terrifying for me. And I still enjoy the protective aspect of my mask, but nowadays it's like people stare at me for wearing a mask. So even that triggers my social anxiety a little bit more. There's just so many elements now with this COVID world that we're living in that make it especially more challenging.
Just when you were talking about masks there, I don't know whether this was something that you had experience of, but I had body dysmorphia. And one big thing that I recognized when we kind of came out of the pandemic was, you know, like we are now, all you can really see is my head. You can't see my body. And so for me, that was like a really overwhelming and daunting thing, was going from people only seeing my face to then people being able to see my whole body in public. And I, at the time, worked online. So, you know, everybody that I worked with, they only saw kind of from here. And when I met them, they were like, oh, I expected you to be taller. And they were very like making a lot of comments about the way that they weren't like, oh, you know, we expected you to be, you know, thinner or larger or anything like that. But it was based on my height. But I was like, if you're noticing my height, what else are you saying that maybe you don't feel is, you know, acceptable to say out loud? So I found that was like a very kind of anxiety provoking thing.
Oh my goodness. I can only imagine. I've been working basically all virtual during this time, but I've heard conversations of former colleagues. Yeah. Saying that same thing, even if it is height, it's still your appearance. Right. And there are things that go unsaid.
Yeah.
Or, oh, you look different than before the pandemic. It's like, what do you mean by that? And even something I've noticed is looking at my face so much. It's almost like a dysmorphia where we're not used to looking at our faces this often. Okay. And it's like, oh, that wrinkle, or, you know, my face isn't symmetrical, which it's not supposed to be, but I never noticed these things before or cared about it.
No. Because before, you would, you know, maybe in the morning when you're getting changed or putting your makeup on, you'll look at your face, maybe in the middle of the day just to check you've got no food in your teeth or something. But I don't think, I mean, I'm talking about this from the perspective of somebody, this is what I think normal. For me, this was not my experience because of the body dysmorphia. Mirror checking is something that I would constantly do. But I would imagine, you know, typically, but like you say now, I don't know about you, but when, even when we're doing this now, I'm constantly looking at my face. I'm like looking at you. I keep trying to pull myself to look at you like we're having a conversation. My eyes are just on me because like you say, I'm checking, checking. And I think, like you say, you become so much more aware of everything that's on your face that before you probably would have never noticed.
Right. And when I think about kids who are looking at their face constantly, and I remember being in that state of going through puberty, it's like you're already, there's enough going on, like you don't need to be staring at your face for so long every single day. So I can only imagine the increased awareness in a negative focus on children and youth, for sure.
Yeah.
It's funny that you said that, though. Now I'm actively trying to look at the camera, and it's so hard. I think as humans, we're just drawn to our face.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And because I think as well, when this records, it makes the other person slightly blurry, whereas my face is clear. It's actually easier for my eyes to look at my face as well. So, but yeah, it's when you recognize it, it's quite funny. I'm now like trying to actively just look away from the screen, right? So in terms of social anxiety disorder, how did you experience that linked to your eating disorder?
I noticed that there are some elements of social anxiety that had nothing to do with food. For example, making eye contact with people, I found was very, very challenging. Coming out of lockdown, it made me, I almost could feel my face reddening. It wasn't something I was used to. It just felt very, very intense to me. And it also felt like they were looking at my appearance and perhaps, you know, comparing and contrasting how I looked before, after, whatever it may be. But one of my deep, deep rooted fears that I still have yet to overcome is eating a full meal out alone by myself. And that is definitely linked to my eating disorder. I have so much respect for people that are just able to go for a dinner out on their own. It was something I was able to do when I was traveling and in new places. But now that I'm back in my hometown, I have this fear that people will judge me for being alone, that I may see someone that I know, that I'll come across as really awkward. Those are all fears that my social anxiety is telling me.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting what you just said about kind of you can do it when you're away, but actually being in like your home environment. I think I said to you before we started this podcast, I went to Fuerteventura and that was a trip on my own. Mm-hmm. And before then I'd never eaten anything on my own. Like I'd never even been to a cafe and got a croissant or something on my own. I don't think I'd even had a coffee on my own. But then all of a sudden it was every single meal was on my own. And I did find, you know, the first few days really, really challenging. Because you know, especially when you're in a holiday environment, it's like everyone's there with their family or with their friends, and they're kind of, you think that they're looking at you like, you know, why are they on their own? But then I started reading and or doing a Sudoku, and then those thoughts sort of dissipated a little bit. But I think, yeah, I think, you know, that sort of eating on your own, especially I think when you have, you know, history of an eating disorder or eating issues, it can be quite challenging. And I felt like I could get away with quite a lot as well, like because it was like a buffet style thing. So I felt, oh, there's nobody here to tell me what I can and can't eat. Right. But then I thought, Hannah, what the hell is the point in doing that? Do not slip into that again.
Good for you. I mean, like the fact that you have that awareness now, but yeah, there's no one holding you accountable. I noticed that too, like working remotely, no longer was I having lunch with my coworkers. So I was like, oh, I could have something that, you know, they wouldn't judge me for. But when you have people around you, it's so interesting how our mind works that way.
Yeah. And actually, we're in situations like that, the only person it's affecting, and this is why I said to myself on holiday, what the hell are you doing? Is you. You know, it's not actually affecting anybody else. You know, it might kind of affect relationships, but fundamentally an eating disorder is affecting you. So it's like, okay, so you're eating what you think other people will want you to eat so that, you know, socially that's acceptable. But when you're on your own, you're not going to. But actually, to be honest with you, most people that are around you, if you, colleagues and stuff like that, probably not even going to notice what you're eating anyway. So you might as well carry on doing it for you.
Totally. And another situation that reminds me of is grocery shopping. I used to truly believe that the cashier was judging what I bought. So it was like, I felt like I needed to impress the cashier or in some ways prove that, you know, oh, I'm actually healthier than everyone else. Like, look at me. Look how good I am at eating. They don't care. They're just swiping.
No. They don't even notice what you're buying.
Oh, no, not at all. So it's like, who am I doing this for? It is, yeah, recovery ultimately at the end of the day, it has to be for you. Like, of course I could keep using these safety behaviors with social anxiety, but that's only going to harm me in the long run.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you, because I think, you know, as you've explained there are definitely links between social anxiety disorder and an eating disorder, but you have said that your social anxiety exists, you know, even when the eating disorder isn't there. And I was having a look at, I'm on the NHS website, which is like, who does the healthcare in the UK, just in case we have people listening who don't know what the NHS are. But basically, like, so it's saying that there's like a, you know, a worry about social activities, and some of that could be eating with other people, worry about doing things that might embarrass you, find it difficult to do things when others are watching you, feeling criticized, having low self-esteem, having symptoms of feeling sick, kind of anxiety related symptoms, I would say. And worrying about everyday activities, such as, you know, speaking to people on the phone or starting conversation. And I guess the reason I wanted to read those out was I wanted to ask, because not everybody with an eating disorder has social anxiety disorder. I think, what was it? I think I put a stat up, didn't I, that 12% of the general population have social anxiety disorder, whereas it's estimated, I mean, this is quite a large estimation, 16 to 88% of those with anorexia or 17 to 65% of those with bulimia. But I guess that's still not everybody. Whereas the symptoms that I mentioned sounded quite similar to eating disorder symptoms. So basically what I'm trying to say in this very long-winded question is, how would you distinguish the two? Because I think there is quite a lot of overlap. Obviously, I don't want people to listen to this podcast and, you know, it'd be great if they listen and think, okay, actually, I think I might need to go and get support for this. But also, I don't want everybody to then think, oh my God, I've got social anxiety disorder, and that to be another thing that they're worried about when actually it's the eating disorder causing those symptoms.
Right, right. I mean, right off the bat, I'm not a clinician. So I think if you do think that would be a conversation definitely to address with whatever your primary healthcare practitioner is. But what I would say from my personal experience is if you take meals and eating out of the equation and you think of other social activities that you're doing. So for example, you mentioned the phone that causes me a lot of anxiety. I need to over rehearse. I need to over practice. That's actually another symptom of social anxiety, is like overcompensating for your perceived flaws. So similar to an eating disorder, the symptoms just affect your life so greatly and negatively impact in a way that makes it hard to function.
Okay.
So the fear is greater than, like, sometimes the fear is too much, I would say as well. Like, I think some people's social anxiety simply can't make phone calls because it's just too terrifying. And that's when my therapist sort of recommended like the tiered approach. And I'm sure this rings a bell for anyone that's gone through CBT therapy, but just, you know, starting with a simple phone call to someone that you know, like calling a parent or a family member, and then eventually working your way up. But I know another big thing for social anxiety is a lot of fear around talking to people in authority figures, whether that's someone who works in healthcare, whether that's a manager, and I certainly experienced that in the workplace. So once I transitioned from school to the work environment, I was noticing it's so hard for me to speak up. I always felt like I needed to know in advance what I was going to say, which just isn't practical in reality.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and thank you for that advice. I think, you know, that'd be really helpful. I think what you said about when you take food out of the equation, I think that was a really good tip to think about. And it's, you know, the tiered approach that you mentioned. And I just want to ask about, I guess, another thing. And I know, like you said, you're not a clinician, but I think it's always good to hear kind of people's experience if they've had experience of it. So basically, this is just coming from what's happened to me kind of within the last week, but I just wanted to ask. So the other day, I was feeling very anxious. I think at the moment, it's like, I'm not sure whether it's anxiety or depression. I think it's like a kind of slurry of both of them together. But then equally, I'm finding it quite challenging. My relationship with exercise is quite compulsive at the moment. And so I was in a bit of a predicament where I hadn't left the house all day because I'd been really anxious about going out, and I'd been had a really low mood. So I'd kind of just like been moping around the house and not doing anything. And I thought, I know right now that what will make me feel better is to get outside and to go and do some exercise. But then I had the kind of compulsive exercise part of my brain like, yes, you need to exercise. You've not done enough exercise today, blah, 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 blah. So basically, what I'm trying to say is, we don't need to sort of like specify it to this situation, but when you have sort of opposing arguments that one would be beneficial for the eating disorder to try and challenge that. Mm. You know, for that instance, that would have been not going to the gym. But then equally, I needed to expose myself because I was getting anxious about going out and seeing people and stuff like that. So it's almost like those opposing things. Do you have any tips for navigating those sorts of situations when kind of you need to do something, but whichever one is kind of feeling like it's feeding into one side?
Yeah. Oh gosh, that's a really challenging situation to be in. I have so much empathy for that. I also struggled a lot with building just a more balanced relationship with exercise. Because when I was at my sickest, one of the first things they told me was, you can't do exercise. So then I began to learn that, well, okay, exercise must be a way to lose weight. And I became really focused on that being my goal with exercise. So since then, I've more thought about it as movement and taken a more gentler approach to it. But like you said, being inside all day, I don't think would make anyone feel better. Like going outside absolutely is like challenging those thoughts around perhaps some underlying social anxiety, but also you don't want to feed into your eating disorder voice that's telling you to really push your body to an extreme, because that would, yeah, it's like you can't have, or you can't win both. But what I would say is, if you can, I think for me, the eating disorder is the hardest and most ingrained voice that I have to challenge. So if my eating disorder voice was telling me to exercise, I know first and foremost, I need to address that before the social anxiety. Like that voice is a lot louder. And I don't know if anyone else can relate to like sort of the voices terminology or that way of seeing your illnesses. But at the end of the day, it is about challenging those thoughts and not giving in to them. So like, yes, you can leave the house, but you know, maybe you could just go for a walk instead. Like maybe you don't need to go to the gym for 3 hours.
Yeah. And actually, you know, now that I'm out of that frame of mind, I think you've just knocked the nail on the head. Like I didn't need to go to the gym. I could have just gone outside and, you know, gone for a little walk or gone sat on a park bench and rang a friend or something. And I think in the moment, I was like, there is no shade of grey here. It's like, you know, we either sit on the sofa or we go to the gym. Yeah. Actually, there's quite a chunk of shade of grey there that I could have kind of played around with. But I think when you're in that moment, that's really, really difficult to acknowledge and to actually make the right decision.
Absolutely. It's so difficult. You're right, though. Like, I think with eating disorders and with anxiety, it's very like black and white thinking. It's all or nothing. It's either I have this wonderful, perfect conversation with a stranger. It's not like I can just go and say hi and then we're just about a bit awkward. Like, no. It has to be pushing myself to the fullest extent possible. I'm thinking about when you went for the 7-course meal. It's like, it's either a 7-course meal or nothing.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. And that was what I had to say to my partner before we walked in the door. I was like, okay, we're practicing shades, because my current thing at the moment is like being in that shade of gray, because like you say, it's so black and white with everything. And I was like, if I don't finish everything on my plate, that's okay. Like, don't be like, you haven't got that tiny little grain of rice or something. Like, just let me do what I think is right. And if that means like leaving a bit, just so that, you know, I have room to enjoy everything, that's okay. I mean, obviously not taking like, you know, that to the extremes and being like all the time when you know that you're actively doing something wrong, being like, oh, it's my shade of gray. I think you can be really honest with yourself. You know what's actually right and what's actually, you know, a very more white or a very more black shade of gray.
I love that you're able to have those conversations with your partner and bring them in and tell them what's going on too. That's huge. I think initially I kept my social anxiety very like holed up. because there was an element of shame. I thought it was just a personal flaw and, oh my gosh, I'm so awkward. People will see me differently. And that's not the case. So the more I talk about it, I think other people can relate to certain aspects of it, or they can help you. So my partner is like super outgoing and probably doesn't have an ounce of social anxiety. But when I struggle to talk about myself or things that are going on, he can help prompt me, and he'll be like, oh, and Chloe did this really cool thing recently. And then that's my cue.
Yeah, that's really good. I think my partner is the same. He's very outgoing and stuff, and I think it really helps. I think it helps. It's quite a good balance to have in a relationship, is, you know, somebody very outgoing and then some maybe that, you know, take a step back a little bit.
Yes.
But it's, if you were both super outgoing, I feel like you could never get one edgeways. So.
Exactly. It's perfect balance.
So to finish us off, I just wanted to talk a little about treatment. And I think you mentioned earlier about some people that have social anxiety disorder that might be difficult around like positions of authority. So that could be a therapist. But do you think there are any other ways maybe that you've experienced or that you've heard other people say in how like social anxiety disorder could affect, I guess, you know, treatment for an eating disorder or for social anxiety disorder?
One of the things that comes to mind is going back to the whole idea of telephoning someone and starting initial conversation can be very, very challenging. Even myself, when I did go through that relapse, it wasn't like I just found the first therapist and called them and jumped into the appointments right away. Like, this took months. I was doing so much research. I believe I had to, you know, like write down a script of questions to ask. I remember just like clutching the phone so hard. Mm-hmm. My hand was turning white. So making that first step, like we talk about it so much where it's like, oh, just ask for help. Just ask for help. It's like, how do you ask for help if asking for help is like, feeds into your mental illness and is like part of it. And that's like a huge barrier. So virtual, like if you aren't comfortable seeing people in person, you know, looking at alternatives, whether it's over the phone, where it's virtual, here in Canada, actually, I did a lot of research into free options because as we know, treatment for eating disorders for any sort of mental illness, can be quite costly. And I found this program called Mind Beacon. And it was really cool because it was like a clinician who would message back and forth. And this was like such a low barrier way for me to start addressing some elements of social anxiety, just like over a chat. And then she gave me readings to do. So if you're able to find those like lower barrier ways to like eventually build up to whatever it is that you're trying to achieve or the thoughts that you're trying to challenge the most, that's what I would recommend.
Yeah, that's such a good idea. Actually, Tessa, who did the episode, it will be last week. So when this comes out, it will have been last week's episode. She has an app called Been There, and that's sort of like it's a chat. And it's just, it's not necessarily therapists. It's people that have got experience of body image issues, and it's like having a sponsor at Alcoholics Anonymous, and you chat through difficult situations. So I imagine that sort of thing would be brilliant if you have got social anxiety, because it's just texting, which may still be anxiety provoking, but you don't have to pick up the phone. You don't have to see someone face to face. So that might be a place to start.
I love that. Yeah, because the peer-to-peer may seem less intimidating than speaking to, you know, psychiatrists or psychologists. Absolutely. It's very validating as well to speak to someone that has gone through something similar.
Yeah, I think that aspect of it, it kind of takes away the judgment as well, I think. Sometimes in eating disorders, or maybe I think there's a bit of like a stigma nowadays that everyone has social anxiety, especially like the younger generation, which is not true. But I think that could be something that you're like, oh, like everyone's got this, so I don't need help for it. But then if somebody else is saying, yeah, as the app is called, I've been there, you can then feel like you get that reassurance and actually you do deserve help and support for whatever's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. It is something that, you know, you can work to overcome. And part of me is remembering times in my life where the social anxiety wasn't as strong and like the freedom that came with that, that always helps me do those things that are super challenging. Even being on this podcast, I don't think a year ago I would have ever reached out to you to consider being a guest. It would have just been way too terrifying. So it's cool that this is showing some sort of progress, and hopefully it's resonating with some of the folks listening as well.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. And I am honored that you feel like you can come on the podcast, because that's totally wonderful. And it's been so lovely chatting to you and, you know, getting all your insight and everything. So thank you so much for coming along. I know you have your blog and your business. So if people want to find out more about you, where can they come along to?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's just been so lovely chatting with you. It feels like we've known each other, and it's so cool that you're all the way across the world. I'm just laughing at what we said about the pudding. That's something I will not forget. But if you're looking to find me online, my website is chloegrande.com. And on social media, on Instagram and Twitter, it's Chloe She Grows.
Amazing. Amazing. Yeah, I might have to put the pudding in the title somehow.
Yeah. Full anyway, of pudding.
I'm blabbing them. Oh, I love it. Yeah, I love it. That's what we'll call this one. Cool. And people will be like, why the hell is that episode called Full of Pudding?
And they'll have to listen. They'll have to listen to find out.
Yeah. All right, it's been so great. Lovely to chat to you.
Likewise. Thanks so much, Hannah.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.